Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome. In the words of a frustrated and opium-addled Jean Cocteau, every time you take your eyes off of her, she changes. In turn, you see a young girl, a schoolboy, a cat, thin lips, fat lips, a slender neck, a Herculean neck, vanquished shoulders, broad shoulders. How do you expect me to draw her? Cocteau, in and out of sobriety, prone to anxiety attacks, struggled to depict the essence of this dazzling German actress named Maria Lani, the it girl of the late 1920s Parisian scene, who seemed to have coalesced out of thin air.
Because she had. She had coalesced out of thin air.
Yes, yes.
Poof.
Poof, poof, poofity-doo. Poofity-doo.
Okay, poofity-doo.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
Unbeknownst to the fashion designers like Lanvin and Chanel flocking to dress her in their luxury wares, the press following her as she floated through crowds to artist studios, where 50-plus of the greatest artists of the day would render her in their vision. Maria Lani, though, was not who she claimed to be. She was not a professional actor. She was not famous. She wasn't even really Maria Lani. Mm. But it led to something phenomenal.
You can almost feel these artists struggling to capture this phantom persona. She was depicted as a faceless heap of half-human, half-like acanthus columns in Dutch angles with like a mime-like kind of tilt-and-stare sort of situation. In 70s shoujo-esque washi layers with like bright El Greco eyes peering through those washi layers. Or cubist angles inverting into themselves. She brought more out of these artists by being a mirror rather than a muse.
Exhibitions of her portraits would enchant New York City, Chicago, London, Berlin, Rotterdam, Paris, and even almost Hollywood. Mm. Now, this fake actress played a role that would win any actor an Oscar before she vanished entirely.
Poof.
Poof-de-doo. Welcome to Art Poof and to a muse you've never heard of and won't ever forget after you've heard her story. I'm Poofany Duenas. And this is Poofel Shoemaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a little later on, we will be joined by the co-creators of the beautiful and brand new art historical graphic novel from Fantagraphics.
So you know it's good.
The Woman with 50 Faces by Jonathan Lachman and Zachary J. Pinson. Mm. But back to Maria. In just about 3 years, thanks to Maria's husband slash agent and her brother pumping fake hype via publishing phony articles in local papers.
In a time when it was like nigh impossible to fact check that shit.
Right on.
Yes. To enunciate.
Yes, you do. Maria managed to charmingly persuade. See? Persuade.
Yeah, you have to enunciate.
You have to persuade. You've never heard of her. You've got to persuade.
Early in the morning, if you don't persuade, if you don't
persuade, you don't get paid.
Yeah. You gotta be persuade to pay.
Okay, I don't know what happened. Maria managed to charmingly persuade the creamiest of the creme artists in Paris, the art capital of the world, to create 50 plus portraits of her under the guise of each artwork playing a central role in an upcoming film, which, of course, would star Maria.
And important to note, she did not pay these artists, okay? They were working essentially on gratis, or the potential of clout, like the potential of clout.
Ooh.
Which I guess plenty of scammers are still trying to pull off on artists today.
Classic scam.
No one dared to question her CV, her fame, or dared to imply all of these artists were not the ineffable truth finders, soul discoverers, and instead were gullible clout chasers as well. It was like a real Emperor's New Clothes sort of situation, which is nude new clothes, which is no clothes, meaning no clothes. The Emperor's no clothes.
Well, they got the wool pulled over their eyes, so some clothes. So the legend grew, and grew, and exhibitions of her portraits traveled, wowing audiences in those cities that we just mentioned, and her fabricated fame grew to the point that they even managed to get Hollywood to sign on to make a movie, which eventually fell through, the one that they had dangled in front of these artists in the first place.
So it's coming full circle.
Exactly.
Grift is full circle. It's a full infinite circle, snake-eating tail, grift sort of situation.
Okay.
The snake's named Grift. That's the snake's name.
Grift.
Yeah, Grift the snake.
Grifton. I like Grifton. Yeah. It rhymes with
I'm going to knock this thing over. I'm going to put it down.
Okay. All right. So what was Maria? Was she a scam artist who maybe possibly pulled off an art heist?
Did it like evolve naturally into kind of like a fake it till you make it sort of law of attraction sort of situation?
Mysterious.
Yeah. That's not, well, it's not. If you buy the book, it's not mysterious.
Well, it is. Actually, it still is a mystery, actually. So anyway.
I'm talking about the book, The Secret, not the book that we're here to talk about
today. Oh, sorry. Okay. Or was it something else entirely?
Mm.
But all of that aside for a moment, like we said up top, what is clear is that while collecting these 50 plus portraits, ranging from drawings, sculptures, painting, and photographs, from the likes of Bonnard, Bossard, Bordel, Braque, Chagall, Chalabordé, Chirico, Cocteau, Delaunay, Deray, Despau, Edzard, Favory, Fujita, Fries, George, Gromaire, Henri Matisse, Ermine David, Kissling, Kramstick, Laborer, Laprade, Loren, Le Falconer, Leger, Lot, Lourjat, Magnetvich, Manray, Marcusis, Marval, Max Band, Max Jacob, Marquet, Mika, Nikun, Orloff, Ozenfant, Papazov, Peshin, Perkrog, Picabia, Poiret, Raoul Dufy, Rolt, Sotine, Souverbi, Van Dongen, Baladon, Zevarkir, Zadkine. All 50 of them. That was 50. That was 50 artists, I think. I lost count and got lost in all the vowels. Okay.
But not Picasso, because he either saw through it or didn't give a fouquet. That's French. Okay. What is phenomenal about this grift, if it actually was indeed a grift, was the work that came out of it, right? Especially the work that struggled to find who Maria Lani actually was. So beyond the portraits that seem kind of like baseline for the artist, right? Like this Bonnard portrait, which is beautiful. I love Bonnard with his soft electric palette, but it doesn't fully rise to the warm, kind of domestic yet ambiguous psychedelic space that his best work does. Mm-hmm. The most intriguing of the bunch seemed to unknowingly grapple with Maria Lani's unknowability.
Matisse, while struggling to capture her in his sketchbook at a cafe, said, quote, "There is something between you and me, Maria. I cannot find you. God doesn't want me to."
Giorgio, Daddy de Chirico.
Long-time
listeners will know Daddy de Chirico because he was the daddy to the surrealists.
Right. Okay. How could
a sex thing.
How could I forget?
The person who left the rude review about me saying that I was doing a sex thing for Giorgio Daddy de Chirico, which I will say, dear reviewer, that says a lot more about you than it does me, wrote, Maria Lani! Repeated through the night, agitating like the sirens in a factory district, end quote, which on paper morphed into a drawing that was very Daddy de Chirico, DDC. A seated faceless figure made up of tall stacks of tumbling acanthus columns and a few human limbs. There was also Man Ray, aka Dude Beams, aka Boy Radiant, aka Guy Laser, El Chamaco Laser in Spanish, I believe.
Lesser?
I hope so. Constructed several different photographs of Maria. Our favorite is her seated in front of an empty chessboard against a dark backdrop, framed off-kilter in red ink, making her pale complexion stand out.
Giving ghostly. It's giving
she's
mime.
She's giving mime. Yeah, exactly.
Braque depicted her in simple lines with an indescript rectangular mask for a face. Jacqueline Marval painted her in these beautiful effervescent washes in oil paint,
which allowed her dark eyes and thick eyelashes to, like, anchor the portrait. It's so beautiful.
Yes. And like we mentioned up top, Jean Cocteau, who believed vehemently in Marie Lani, number one fan, was also her first mark. He also struggled greatly to depict her in a way that was satisfying, which maybe should have raised a red flag.
Or two.
Right.
Or three.
Saying, quote, "Suddenly, scales fall from my eyes. Madame Lani is painting me."
Rhymes. Rhymes.
Did I make it rhyme?
It's a rhyming thing.
So with all of these artists signing on, a whole traveling exhibition that was extremely popular, newspaper articles from fabricated sources to draw from, and even an almost made Hollywood movie, why haven't we heard about?
Right, right. Even if we take the most unfavorable opinion of her, that she was a scam artist, why isn't this the most well-known scam artist in the art world? Well, she disappeared after 1931, and eventually the scales did fall from the very same opium-addled poet, playwright, artist who struggled to capture her essence, that Jean Cocteau, eventually became her biggest detractor, starting a smear campaign which became accepted fact. And just as quickly as Maria came to fame, she was forgotten. But the truth, as the author of The Woman with 50 Faces discovered, was much more complicated. So let's give a warm art slice welcome to Jonathan Lachman and the illustrator of the graphic novel, Zachary J. Pinson. We're going to talk about the book, the creation and research, and also get into the nerdy details of making the book. If you're an art historian or just a creator of any sort, there is a lot to glean from their insights.
You can follow along with the images we discuss on YouTube, or you can switch Spotify from audio to video. Zencaster did lose Jonathan's video feed. Sorry about that, Jonathan. We did put a nice picture of you up there, though.
We did.
Yes.
While you are there, like and subscribe.
Yeah, hit all 5-star buttons.
Yeah.
All 5.
Nada
even
menos.
If you don't like me, all 5.
But you like
Stephanie
me.
Works hard.
Yeah.
So do I.
Actually. Nada menos de 5 estrellas. Thank you so much. Thank
hard.
You so much. It helps us grow and reach more folks like yourselves. Also, please sign up for our algorithm-proof email so you can be alerted to new episodes at artslicepod.com.
Get some cool shit. Get some cool shit on that email.
In your inbox.
Yeah, some cool shit.
Right in your inbox.
A steaming cool pot. Okay. If you want to support the making of our show, which helps us, you know, visit a lot of the works that we cover in person, you can grab some merch at the aforementioned artslicepod.com, or you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/ artslicepod. Okay, we're going to fade in to the interview now. We will be wearing different clothes. I might be wearing a hat, different glasses. We'll see.
We'll see. We're not even talking about my hair. There's a lot of mystery. There's disguises. There's your favorite famous artists and some of them that you hate. An almost art heist.
It's a bit of an art heist. Almost, I guess.
Yeah. Which I
and
love.
Nazis, of course. Nazis, I feel like, are everywhere.
Always Nazi.
In history and even today, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. So basically a story that was overlooked in art history.
So yeah, Stephanie and I received an early copy of this and we were just so engrossed by it. So, but before we get into all of that, do you both want to let our listeners know like what you each did on the book, like what your roles are and kind of how that played out?
I guess I'll start since I was the first one to come across her and get this whole thing rolling.
Yeah.
I was studying for my oral exams for my art history PhD. And so just like consuming book after book nonstop for 3 months. And I read in a footnote about this woman who had been portrayed by 50 artists. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like I was trying to think of an example of someone who had been portrayed by that many people, let alone in 1 year. There were like some kings and queens, you know, who had a lot of portraits done, but almost never someone, you know, like a rando. And so I kind of filed that away as an interesting tidbit, something to look into later when I had more time. And then following year when I was in Paris working on my dissertation, I was, you know, in these very dusty archives and libraries, and you'd often have to wait a long time between submitting a request for a book or a newspaper or something and then actually having it appear on your desk. And so while I was waiting, I just started poking around in their catalogs and databases and things to see if there was anything about this obscure woman that I had really not been able to find much information about. Mm-hmm. The more I dug into her, the more contradictions kind of piled up in her story, and the more nothing really made sense. There was the story she told about herself when she appeared in Paris in 1928. And then there was the story that started to get told about her when she died in 1954. And the more I dug into it, the more I found that neither of those stories were quite true. Just to give like a quick summary, she shows up in Paris in 1928, presenting herself as this silent film star from Berlin who's at work on a movie about an art collector and needs tons of portraits of herself to be in the movie as props. And all of the great artists sort of get entranced with the idea of their paintings and sculptures appearing in her movie. And everyone from Matisse, Chagall, Soutine, Leger, Man Ray, almost every great artist you can think of living in Paris at the time, and there were so many, ended up doing her portrait. And a huge exhibition of these portraits traveled around the world. And eventually a movie did actually start to get made about her, with Thomas Mann wrote the screenplay and Jean Renoir signed on to direct and Greta Garbo to co-star. And then nobody really hears all that much about her or from her after, you know, like 1930. And so that kind of opened the door to rumors, especially after she died. And this rumor started to spread around that, in fact, she had not been a silent film star from Berlin, but rather a con artist from Warsaw who had made off with all of the portraits from her show and sold them to unsuspecting American collectors. So the book kind of dives into how much of both of those stories is true and what else is true that no one had yet discovered. I made a lot of really interesting discoveries and archives over in the course of working on it, and then eventually decided that it really needed to be a book and really wanted it to be a graphic novel. I had fallen in love with graphic novels and then had the good fortune to meet Zach about a decade ago. We got to work on it, but that it still took another decade. He'll explain a bit about it, his process and why it's, you know, just as time intensive and painstaking as the archival digging process.
10 years, yeah. That's a long time, Zach.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was some, it was off and on, you know, I mean, it was a lot of years though. Yeah.
I'm joking. Like,
I could say, we took like, yeah, I'm like, well, we took like 3 months off there or something. Yeah. I was at a local art show with my friend, and she was talking to this lady, and the lady was like, "What do you do?" And I was like, "Oh, I do like painting and drawing, and I always have done comics." Well, before I got into college and into more fine art stuff, I was always doing comic stuff. I was showing her on my phone, and yeah, she was like, "You need to meet my husband." And John was across the room, and she grabs him, and John told me this Maria Alani story. And I was hooked. I was like, typically I draw really very gross, hellish, you know, kind of, I hate the word apocalyptic because it's overused, but yeah, I mean, just, yeah, kind of destructive type environments and figures and stuff. And yeah, I thought it was odd that, you know, John and his wife saw something in me, but maybe they thought I was like very dedicated. Like I go hard with whatever subject matter, but it turned into like a 10 plus year working relationship. I say John, he brought out the love in my work and stuff. Typically I was more like doom and gloom and stuff, but yeah, he showed me a little more tender side, you know, because, you know, the book covers, you know, a person's life and there's so many parts of it. And so a person can like hopefully identify with certain parts of it and stuff. And yeah, there's like, you know, the art scene, there's, you know, a love story, survival. And yeah, I'd really locked into the art scene and the love story in it. And I don't know, when someone tells you an idea and you have just a very intense visual, you know, it's just visualized in your head. I just felt like I had to depict it and yeah, help John along. Is that an answer? I don't know.
That is an answer for sure. And no, I see, like, I was a big comic book nerd when I was a kid. So I definitely feel that, you know, 90s influence of those kind of like posts. I'm thinking of like Todd McFarlane, people like that. There's a bit of grossness there, but also like, yeah, the tenderness really translates as well. So you did a good job of like threading that needle. And it also, I think I heard right, you have like kind of a fine art background as well. So I think there's a lot of like fine art overlap in your work. Do we want to talk about, I guess we'll talk about that now. Yeah. And then we'll jump back into the story of Lonnie. Is it Lonnie or Lainey? Maria Lainey?
I mean, we don't know how she...
Okay, that's a good point.
We'll use both. All right.
We need like another 10 years or something to get some of these names right.
Well, I was the thing that really caught me about the book right away, obviously I'm very visually... we're both artists. Stephanie and I are both artists. Stephanie's more the art historian. I'm not more the artist, but I don't have the art history background. So what took me right away was like, it's very cinematic. The work is very cinematic, but there's all these moments of fog almost with your line work that is so immersive, but also it reminds me a little bit of Intaglio prints.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely that. And then, the 90s sort of almost like classy Chupo animation sort of looking work where it's a little bit European inspired. So there's a lot going on there that was just like, you know, making my little art dopamine kind of fire. you did an excellent job.
Good call, because I kind of developed my style. I made like a big change when I got into Intaglio. So, yeah.
Okay, so I'm not super wrong there, but it's ink, right? Were you doing this by hand?
By hand with like technical pens and stuff, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's why it took 10 years. It's a lot of work.
For sure.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, for people who haven't seen the images yet, like there are so many strokes of ink in these extremely detailed pages. I mean, we at one point counted up the number of strokes on one page, which took us a while. And then we multiplied by the number of pages and we estimated about 500,000 strokes in the whole book.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know how to submit to the Guinness Book of World Records. Or I don't know. Like, make a new category.
Get on their wait list.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like I had a lot of thoughts while I was reading it. One was like Maria was, I don't know, this is kind of weird, but she's almost like a proto influencer in a way. Like, it's really it's really like there are so many people now like catfishers with face augmentation apps, things like that, where you can just like totally like and reinvent yourself, and like she was able to do that through the works of these artists. I don't know, that's kind of odd. And also I think you talk about this in, well, it's kind of very clear in the book, but she's really inverting that sort of muse to artist relationship. So that was something that was really interesting too, where it just, it was really interesting to see her come in and like assert herself in those positions and really take over.
Flipping the tables.
Yeah, a little bit, right? Yeah. As far as the like art history side of things, it really reminded me of, we covered a couple of years ago, the Bellamy International, what was it called?
Art competition.
Art competition, where they had a bunch of surrealists. Who was in it? Lenora Carrington,
Max
Dorothea
Ernst.
Tanning. Yeah.
There were like
Horace
10.
Pippin. Yeah,
Horace
yeah.
Pippin.
Ivan Albright. So basically they all created works around Saint, oh my God.
The theme
saint?
Of the Temptation of Saint Anthony.
Saint Anthony.
And this was for a cameo in a movie, in a Hollywood movie.
In a Hollywood
so actually
movie.
Kind of, right. In a way similar to Maria Lonnie's story.
But it was really good to see like all these different artists take on like a singular subject and really kind of like show their own touch as far as that was concerned. And also it was going to be in a movie. Well, one of them was selected for the movie, so a movie was actually made. And that's very similar to the 50 different works for Maria Lonnie. Like, it's it's really lovely to see all these different artists take her on in these different ways.
I came from having been a physics major in high school, in college, and it almost seemed like a scientific experiment, right? Where, like, the model is staying the same, but the artist is changing, and therefore maybe you then get to see what each artist brings to the process that the other artists don't. I also thought it was fascinating that she definitely seriously inflated her resume and seriously exaggerated how far along her movie project was. And I thought it was amazing that all these artists who, especially at this moment in art history, really kind of pride themselves in being able to look past appearances and down to the essences of things, were completely taken in by her. And very few people suspected her. And also, I just thought it was an amazing instance of like this sort of artist model who's normally in the background and kind of subsidiary being as important as the artists themselves, being a kind of impresario or co-creator in this artistic experiment. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, in art history, I feel like artist models get short shrift and are kind of dismissed. I mean, they're usually women, right? So that plays a role, the sexism that runs through art history. And yeah, it just seemed like she had pulled off this amazing thing and no one was talking about her. And that that seemed to be in need of being remedied. And the more I kind of found out about how she had been, I think, unfairly maligned after her death as a thief, it just made me all the more want to try to kind of win a measure of justice or respect for her, at least posthumously.
Yeah. And in a way, you all created yet another portrait of her. So with the book. So, I mean, it's just kind of adding on to that. Like, I want to make a portrait of her.
Yeah.
Experiment.
Yeah. We've actually been thinking about at our book events, having some paper and some art materials and inviting people to make their own portraits.
That's such a good idea.
Obviously, they can't do it from life, but we have photographs of her and stuff.
From the story. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. We'll ask our listeners to see if they want to submit some portraits. That'd be great.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to go back to talking about Zachary's styles. I wanted to jump in back to the Bellamy International Art Competition, that surrealist competition. So Zachary, your work reminded me of Ivan Albright, who has this very grotesque sort of style. A painting, and he's really known for, he actually did a portrait of,
Dorian Gray.
Yeah. Yes. And actually that one too is in a movie.
Yeah.
Yes. And I've really grown to love black and white work because it really forces you to slow down and pay attention to like the change in line work, the change in shade, the change in tone, everything.
And light. Yeah. Just light in general and stuff. Yeah.
So at first this was a challenge for me. I was like, oh no, I thought this was going to be like colorful, blah, 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 like whatever I thought. But But I really enjoyed it because it forced me to slow down. And there's not like a ton of dialogue, but there is when it comes to like all the mark making and stuff. So like you really have to slow down. And again, just your drawing style was also a nice, I think, juxtaposition to like the sort of, I don't know, you would call it like, I don't know, facade, like the sort of like Hollywood sheen that the story could have had, if that makes sense. So I really enjoyed that part. And I enjoyed, too, how it is very cinematic. And there's the B plot of Jean Cocteau, not to, like, you know, say too much. But I was like, oh, we're lingering a lot on his story. Yeah, and I love it. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I just really like to push the images and what's weird is like the more, as the years pass, I'm getting more detailed, which makes me more slower. So, because I just want to make it more refined and stuff.
Yeah, I can relate to that, actually. It's like, do I really want to start a drawing right now? It's going to take me 2 hours.
And it's like, I don't know, like, I feel like it does have like this like distortion, but like soft. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's hard to do like a soft light in this style, but like, I don't know, at least like a distortion. And with painting and stuff, I like when paintings are like thick and sculptural and not so flat. And it's like, well, how do you do that with like ink on paper? And I don't know, it's I don't know, I could like get a brush and flick paint but yeah, thank you for reacting to it. I care. It's just something I care about. And it's like, I don't know, maybe someone's just gonna flip the page in 2 seconds, even though it's been like hundreds of hours. It's just like, I feel like people can tell when something might be like handmade or something, you know. And it's like, hopefully all visual artists can ask is for, you may spend like an extra minute with their piece.
I also was blown away by how you, as much as you were immersed in all of those little details, you really gave so much thought to the composition of each page, right? All the panels kind of add up to an overall composition. And I find
for sure,
so many pages I can just kind of stare and stare at, like as I, like I would a painting, because it has that kind of visual unity to it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely lingering around the splash pages for sure. Like all the lines and, you know, it's funny because sometimes like the, the bigger pages like were really drawing me in. So that's awesome. Was there a, Jonathan, was there a thought, like why did you decide to do this as a graphic novel when it could have been like an essay or it could have been a different sort of format? What drew you to the graphic design format? Or I'm sorry, the graphic novel format?
I felt like her, first of all, her story really needed to be a book. That I mean, I did publish an article about it before doing it as a book, but that was sort of mostly to try to scare up anyone who might know more about her to get in touch with me. But my ultimate goal was a book because I felt like her story was just that big. It needed to, needed that kind of a treatment. But at the same time, her being dead and not having any survivors, I didn't really have enough archival information to really fill 300 pages of just text. So I started trying to think about creative solutions. I suppose at first I thought maybe, oh, well, I could kind of pad out her story with historical material and, you know, stuff about the era and whatnot. But I don't know. I kind of felt like that would just kind of dilute her story. I mean, obviously you need some of that in any kind of story about her, but I didn't want it to overwhelm her story. And I just so happened, as I was kind of weighing all these issues in my mind, I happened to read this graphic novel, Logic Comics, that came out in the late 2000s by these Greek artists and authors about, so it's a graphic novel about the history of the philosophy of math, which sounds like an extremely unlikely topic for a graphic novel. And it I mean, it is, right?
They're putting it in the Marvel universe next time or something.
I got sucked in just by the improbability of it. And I ended up finishing the book and loving it. And I was like, wow, if this could be a graphic novel, I mean, really anything could be a graphic novel. I suppose other people had taken the graphic novel in surprising directions before, but my knowledge of the medium at that point was pretty limited and stereotypical. And I didn't, up until that point, I didn't really necessarily think that my story about Marie Alani could be a graphic novel easily, until I saw that. And I was like, well, then it could really go in any direction. So yeah, I started looking around for an artist. It took me a couple of years before I met Zach. And I was just so entranced with his style. I was like, well, first of all, I love his style. And then second of all, it was a style that I felt like I hadn't seen in the graphic novel realm insofar as I had explored it. And so the idea of bringing something really fresh to it and something that really felt like it was not just illustration, but art. I know those are kind of like extremely complex categories that I don't want to be glib about it, but I felt like with so many of the graphic novels that I read as I got to know the medium that after I finished them, I didn't have any desire to reread them or to continue staring at the pages because it just didn't quite have that aesthetic weight or complexity to it that I was hungering after. And then when I saw his style, I felt like, wow, if he were to do this book, like I would read it and reread it and reread it.
Gotcha. Absolutely. Yeah. There's sometimes like a slickness with illustration that just doesn't like hold your gaze as much as like work that can be made by hand. Well, not that illustration's obviously made by hand, but especially with a lot of it going digital, it sometimes just loses that hand approach. That's just really crucial, especially when you're talking about historic painters who, were all about like, you know, slashing away at the canvas until like something came out of it. Do you have a favorite work from the painters that or the artists that took that did a Maria Lani portrait?
I've tried to see as many of the portraits in person as possible, but it's pretty difficult because, you know, museums only show like 2% of what they own. And if they're in private collections, it's even harder to get a look at them. But I feel like I can't really pass judgment on the ones that I haven't seen in person. But of the ones I have seen in person, the one that most entranced me was by Suzanne Valadon.
Okay.
And I really adore that painting, and that's in it. I saw it in an exhibition in Milan, and I just stood in front of it forever. I mean, it was one of those sessions of staring at a painting where the guard sort of comes over and is like, "Are you okay?" like maybe I was going to a fugue state or something. Right? And it's just such an amazing composition, and the color is fantastic. And I was glad that we were able to work into the book chapter about her, because also her life was just so fascinating and, and complicated. And yeah, she's a fascinating figure.
Yeah, I haven't seen, obviously we haven't seen any of these in person. I really liked the, what we could find online. I really liked the De Chirico drawing, but you know, it's just kind of seemed like a De Chirico drawing. And then there was it Marvell?
I don't know.
Jacqueline Marvell.
Jacqueline Marvell.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope I'm saying that right. That one was really beautiful from what I could tell. Did you have a favorite?
I liked, I think it was George Brock's. It was just so unexpected when you see them all together and then you see suddenly there's like a mask and it's just like, it's very minimal. I mean, almost as minimal as Jean Cocteau's, but that one just kind of took me by surprise. And I don't know. I'm just drawn to that one out of all of them.
Yeah.
It's really hard to pick, honestly.
Yeah. Zach, what was your favorite?
I haven't seen any of them in real life either. But yeah, I did like Susan Daladon's stuff. But just a few weeks ago, John got an email from someone that has Roman Kremstick. How do you say it?
I think that's as good. That's as good as I'm going to do. Yeah.
We were working sometimes with the most low res JPEGs of this work. And sometimes a lot of them in just black and white. And then all of a sudden this person found this Roman piece and he emailed this incredibly high def photo of this painting. And there was all these colors in it and stuff that I was just like, I had no idea like that was in it. And yeah, it's funny how like this story is still unfolding. Mm-hmm. Like John will find something new. And I mean, even while we were making the book, we would have to go back to some early year and fit in certain things and like sew it back in to make it make sense and stuff. And we're anticipating that, yeah, we'll get some news and maybe someone being like, you did everything wrong or you did everything right and stuff. But either way, the exciting thing is maybe, these paintings, we could get some like really nice photos of them and stuff, discover like, yeah, there's like a lot of color in it, or I don't know, the mark making and stuff with the Roman piece. Yeah, the paint was really thick and you know, and you could see it in the photo and it was almost sculptural and stuff.
Definitely underappreciated artist. I was not very familiar with his work, and that painting totally blew me away.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I wish I could hold it up to the camera. I don't know if it's going to like work too well. I don't know. It's
like, we could probably send you an image that you could put up on the page for anybody who wants to.
But yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And I mean, this still doesn't do it justice because, you know, it's over this tiny camera. But
screen
on
the screen, yeah.
But yeah, the blues, the burnt umbers, siennas, I don't know, it's great.
Right now it's a photo of a photo of a photo, so we're good there. But yeah, anything we can share that. And I'm sure you'll have more people come out of the woodwork, hopefully, for those missing pieces as this book gets a little more steam.
I'm slowly putting on the website for the book, marialani.com, all of my archival materials. So I'm going to put up there every image I have of every artwork that I know of.
Oh, awesome.
And also more about the documents and the process of making the book and so on.
Right on.
Well, speaking of making the book, we actually wanted to ask you a little bit more about your collaboration process. So like we mentioned, we're both artists, but we have our own ways of researching things and kind of getting stuff done, and sometimes we butt heads a little bit. But we wanted to know how you were able to split things up and collaborate, because I'm sure Jonathan letting go of some of your vision so that Zach could bring it to life might have been difficult at times.
Yeah, I mean, I had a strong feeling from the beginning that as much as I could give up control, the better the finished product would be. So I tried to just give Zach all of my raw materials. And then, you know, we had to sort of work together to figure out like, okay, how many pages are we going to devote to this scene or that scene? Or, you know, because the book can only be so many pages. And, you know, there are so many chapters of her life that could have been a book unto themselves that we had to really kind of ration ourselves in a sense. And so we had to work pretty closely on coming up with like an outline for the book. But then after that was done, then I tried to just say like, okay, here's all the stuff, like see what you can do in six pages. And then he did all the work of figuring out, okay, we're going to break this page up into 9 panels and this page will be 2 panels. And a lot of the minutia of like the text we ended up editing later, but he sort of took the first crack at that generally. And then we went back through it all. And, you know, if there were things that were a little bit unclear or we weren't holding the reader's hand enough, then we might go in and tweak the text or occasionally go in and tweak the images. But it all pretty, 95% of the time, it kind of turned out the way that Zach originally envisioned it. And there were like maybe one or two times where his, you know, the sort of horror grotesque part of his imagination left back to life it a little bit too aggressively for this particular story.
A lot can happen in 10 years, you know.
We had to like write it back a little bit. But I really did also want that part of his repertoire in the book because there are parts of her story that are grotesque and yeah. crazy and horrific. Mm-hmm. And I feel like he really was able to really show the emotional range of this story in a yeah. way that mm-hmm. words by themselves really never could have done justice.
Absolutely. Yeah, collaborating is always interesting. And then also, not saying this is at all like a fictional book, but there are obviously like some elements that you have to kind of put in that are, you know, maybe taking your best guess. Like that's something we always struggle mm-hmm. with when we create episodes is like we might have a bit of the story and we're kind of filling in a bit mm-hmm. here and there that's kind of left up to interpretation. But overall, like I think that like reshuffling process of like collaborating can be really, really good. And then taking your time with it too, like I made a joke about the 10-year sort of thing, but like so much stuff is just churned out so quickly that, you know, like you were saying, like some of the graphic novels you were looking at, it's like you almost forget about it, like, you know, after you're done reading it. And yeah, making the reader slow down, making the reader feel something, making them feel it through the story and feel it through the illustration or the art is like so important. You artist listeners and storytelling listeners, like definitely, you know, this is something to learn from for sure.
Yeah. And I just feel, yeah, the slower you go, the more you get to know your subject. Mm-hmm. I don't know. or hopefully, I don't know.
Yeah.
It was a very smooth collaboration process. And Zach and I didn't really know each other that much mm-hmm. going in, but for some reason we clicked and really saw things the same way almost all the time. So I'm very, very grateful for that. We probably wouldn't have survived a process this long if we didn't feel that way.
We kept each other excited the whole way and everything. And if I felt burnt out, like John was like, yeah, by all means, take a week off and stuff like that. Yeah. But I do remember like, because there are graphic novels out there, yeah, nonfiction ones that it is just kind of data points. But, you know, it's just talking heads and it's just like, oh, and then I go, you know, and we were in this room in 1904 and then, you know, and then this happened. And I was really resisting trying to just have a book filled with data points of, mm-hmm. you know, where the characters were and what they did. And then they left and stuff. Because we did the book all out of order. Sometimes we would really go, John would be like, I have a really exciting part that feels finished. So like, let's go with that. And then we'll revisit something else. But I remember one of the first things we were doing was the John Cocteau, like I call him like psychedelic pages mm-hmm, yeah. where he's drawing Maria and stuff. And I remember that was kind of a test to see if how John, like, if, yeah, he'll give me the thumbs up and everything. Cause yeah, he gave me the writings and everything. And I was like, okay, well, this is what I was thinking. And, you know, and then this part, he rips his face off and his skull's revealed and stuff. And, John just gave the green light. He was like, go with it. And I was like, this is going to be great.
Well, I mean, that was the perfect moment to bust out, right? Because Cocteau was, I mean, he was an opium addict. He was, mm-hmm. and had, he probably, even when he was not on opium, he had a tremendous imagination. And the stuff mm-hmm. that he wrote yeah. about his sessions with Mirjolani is just so wild and evocative yeah. and kind of, you know, apocalyptic. That was a gold mine, his writings about that. Also, we did end up finding a bit of her, the memoir that she was writing mm-hmm. when she died. It's, the manuscript has never been found, but I found that it was an excerpt from it was published in a newspaper while she was still alive about her session with Jules Pachin. So that became an opportunity to put her own words into the book. And that was really okay. exciting. And there were other places where we had to, you know, we didn't have firsthand accounts of exactly what went on in mm-hmm. these rooms that she passed through. And I had to use a little bit of imagination. And that's mm-hmm. another thing that I'll kind of spell out the website for people who are curious to know what's exactly, you know, known to be true and what's mm-hmm. a little bit more speculative.
Yeah, for sure. And so the John Cocteau part where he is kind of losing it is really gripping. And then I think the other part that really stuck with me was, of course, like the Nazi occupation. Going from place to place to place, just like always running from something, was, you know, another sort of like sub story that was, I don't want to say relatable because I've never lived through anything like that, but especially for like the time, like really relatable to what, you know, we hear on the news and things like that.
Which yeah. is a lot in common with the artists around that time because they were also fleeing.
Yeah, a lot of them fleeing. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe that was a little early, but maybe a few years later. But a lot of the artists, modern artists that we cover mm-hmm. were European mm-hmm. and they had to leave. And, you know, they ended up in New York or they ended up in Mexico City. So mm-hmm. actually her story is very similar to theirs. And I don't know, all the more it makes me feel like she needs to be in the art history books. Like she took back the story of the muse. She like mm-hmm. rewrote that, you know, like that no one else has that story that we know of yet. So she's super important. And I really hope that people pick up this book and learn more about her. And maybe you'll find out more about Maria Lani. Someone out there knows something.
Yeah, absolutely. Pick up the book. And then if you can't afford it for some reason, go to your library and ask them yeah. to grab a copy. That's a good way to get it in front of people, too.
They so, can do that.
Yeah. Libraries will do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's you have to go out in person into the real world.
Support your libraries.
Definitely. Okay.
Well, yeah. Where can people find, you mentioned Maria, did you say marialani.com? Are there, is that correct? Or are there other places where people can find your work?
That's the URL for the website. And Zach is on Instagram. I'm not really on much social media, but if people want to contact me, my email address is on the website, or I also have a personal website, johnlackman.com.
Great. Well, we will definitely link all those. And yeah, it's from Fantagraphics, right? The book is from Fantagraphics.
Oh, yeah.
Really great
we
publisher.
We love Fantagraphics. Yeah.
Great publisher. I have a lot of books from them.
It's worth saying that they gave us total creative control over the book.
They're dress makers.
Can I ask about what that process was like trying to get someone to publish this? Because, I mean, you guys were working on it for 10 years. How long did it actually take to get someone to agree?
That was a long saga.
That's
as well.
A loaded,
yeah,
that's
okay,
a loaded
too
long.
I can give you the short version. Yeah,
okay.
I mean, so going into this experience, I already had a literary agent, so that helped us get started. Once we had a certain, maybe a third of the book done and an outline mm-hmm. of the rest of it, she shopped it around to a bunch of publishers. And there was some interest, but the ones who were interested wanted to make big changes to it that we didn't really think were a good idea. So we mm-hmm. decided to just try to finish the book and then try again with the publishers. And so then fast forward a few years, we finished the book and our agent sent it out again. And again, no publisher said yes. I kind of felt, and she kind of felt like, oh, well, we'll wait another couple of years and we'll try again. Zach was like, you know, I know she's been sending out by email and I know that's like industry standard or whatever, but I really feel like this book, to get it, you have to really hold it in your hands mm-hmm. on paper. Mm-hmm. And so he went and ran off 20 copies and sent it to all the publishers that our agent had been querying. And that was when Gary Groth at Fantagraphics read it.
Within a month.
Read it, fell in love with it, and immediately made us an offer. So we were thrilled. I mean, that was our number one choice of publisher going into this whole process. So we were just ecstatic.
That's amazing.
Once again, yeah, it's not on a screen. You're actually looking at it.
It reminds me of sending like demos to like record companies like back in the day. Like you just have to hear it for yourself.
Are there things that we missed that maybe you want to speak to?
No, I think particularly from an art angle, we hit all the major topics. I mean, her activities during the war and everything, mm-hmm. I think, are a whole fascinating other chapter, but maybe a bit of a dogleg from the art conversation.
I guess, I'm going to be working on my own book and hopefully get time to do some paintings and stuff. So
right on.
Hopefully it doesn't take 10 years, but yeah.
Thank y'all for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
Super fun.
And we will definitely ask our listeners if they want to submit a drawing or something of Maria Lani. we'll share it with you all.
I'd love to see that. Yeah, we'll totally share them.
We'll put them in the second edition or something.
You know there was going to be a second edition. listeners, I just realized it's spelled wrong. Listeners, we would love to see your version of Maria Lani. Send them over to artslicepod@gmail.com and we will share it with our audience.
Like we mentioned, you can pick up The Woman with 50 Faces from Fantagraphics from your local bookseller. If you don't have the funds, go to your local library. Make eye contact with a librarian. I know how it is. You're in your studio. You're in your research lab. Your research stacks.
In your room. In your home.
Mm-hmm. If you're doing your research, okay? And you go to a library, you got to interact with people. People in the real world. And you're like, how did I get here? Why am I here? This is weird. This is a weird new sensation. This is air I'm uncomfortable with. Anyway, you can talk to them about, you know, carrying the book in their library. And that way, you get to experience the story of Maria Lani instead of just, like, hearing about it. It's such a great book. You need to experience it by, you know, putting your fingers on it and stuff like that. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe so we can reach more folks like you.
Nada menos que cinco estrellas, please.
Sí. Go to artslicepod.com to sign up for our free newsletter so you can get alerts from our latest episodes. Sans the algorithms.
And yes, we could always use your support creating these episodes. So please grab some merch or you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/artslicepod. Any way that you can help, we honestly, truly, earnestly appreciate you from the bottom of our little corazones.
Sí.
We love you.
Sí.
We will be back with a new episode very, very soon.
And don't forget, your kid couldn't have seduced 50 plus of the greatest artists in Paris to create a portrait of them under the guise that will be used for in a major motion picture.
Right.
Maybe they could have, though. Mm. These kids are pretty tech savvy. We don't know your kid. We don't know. Honestly, we don't know your kid. We're just making judgments. We don't know your kid. Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye.